On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
We heard from the Taoiseach yesterday that we could be facing into a fairly lengthy stretch of public health restrictions, that although present lockdown may perhaps be relaxed by the end of February, all going well, that we will still be looking at several months of having to live with further restrictions. And of course, as this begins to grate on everyone, perhaps the messaging and the motivation will be called more and more into question. So let's talk to someone who knows a little bit about what we can do to try and keep people motivated and to manage expectations for a month ahead. Professor Pete Lunn is the Head of Behavioural Research at the ESRI, and he's with us now. Pete, good afternoon. Thanks very much for taking our call.
Good afternoon, Gavin.
It's going to be a long haul, as we know from the Taoiseach yesterday and we know from the Taoiseach just speaking on this programme just after Christmas. We're going to have some restrictions for a little while, but unfortunately the scale of the situation right now means that we're going to have to remain in full level 5 lockdown for at least another month and potentially more. You can understand how that will begin to grate on a lot of people. Would have been in lockdown for all of January, all of February, for all of November, for half of October. Some counties were in heightened restrictions before that as well. As a general rule, how do you keep people motivated to keep plugging away with such difficult restrictions on their lives?
Well, it's a difficult question, isn't it? But I have to confess, I somewhat want to attack the premise of it. And what I mean by that is this. Since the start of this pandemic, there has been concern among authorities and among journalists that somehow people's willpower and resolve would just at some point ebb away and that they'd just stop bothering, essentially. And it's a concern and a kind of insecurity that I think has been argued in public life consistently. And I've just heard it again in your intro to this piece there. There isn't actually, as of now, really any evidence at all that it's true. Now, that doesn't mean it won't become true. I'm just saying that throughout the whole pandemic so far, there hasn't been any evidence that there's some just kind of general sort of fatigue effect where people are getting sick of it and giving up. I mean, in fact, quite the reverse. So if you look at what's happened since Christmas, I mean, in fact, there's been a really sharp increase in the number of people who are staying at home and not going out and are reporting abiding faithfully by the restrictions, more so than a couple of months ago. And interestingly, that increase in people's willingness to stick to the guidance and wanting to follow the guidance, that has actually been sharpest among young adults, who were the people who we had most concern about during the autumn period, that they were going about too much business and were likely to spread infection. So there isn't really any evidence for it yet. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
Well, I suppose that's the point I suppose maybe I'm getting at. And I take your point that maybe we're just kind of presuming that, you know, adherence will begin to wane as people become more frustrated. But I suppose even if there isn't any evidence that there aren't, and maybe there is evidence, and I might put that to you in a moment, but that there's always the risk that if people are not given some sense of light at the end of the tunnel, and it's very difficult to see when that light might come, that you can understand how it will begin to grate on people and maybe they might feel resigned to it and not adhere the way that they should.
Well, that's the theory. As I said, the theory's been there for almost a year now, and it's not so far received any evidence. So I don't disagree with you about giving people positive things. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the interesting things actually is that we appear to be coping better as time goes on, not worse. So if you look at kind of the mental health and well-being data, the biggest hit was actually taken during the first lockdown, and we've adapted to our circumstances since then. So people have actually improved their mental health and well-being through the course of 2020. So people are learning to cope, but I mean, we really do need to keep spreading positive messages. And one of the really important things to spread, I think, is actually that people really do have resolve. I mean, the data do clearly show that people are willing to endure this because they know they have to. I mean, if you see the stories day after day that are coming out of the health service at the moment and the infection rates, the primary thing that's driving people's behavior throughout this pandemic is their level of concern and anxiety, not just for themselves, but primarily for the people they love and their relatives. And that's the main driver of people's behavior. And that's why they're adhering to these restrictions, because they can see the logic of it. They can see what happens if we don't.
Okay.
And that's really important to understand, that there's some solidarity there, that the large proportion, and it really is the overwhelmingly large proportion of the population, has some solidarity and is doing this because they know that they need to. So telling people that, reminding people of that, I think is a really important thing to be doing.
Can I put my personal theory in all of this too? And I do take the point that maybe we're over-egging the degree of non-compliance, because as you say, the vast majority of people aren't out on the roads, they're not going out to restaurants that aren't there or that anyway, but that they're not going to visit friends and family in each other's homes. By and large, they're playing by the rules exactly as they ought to. But there's a bit of me sometimes that thinks that when the first lockdown kicked in, people were very much motivated to go home and stay there. partly because, yes, there was that sense of civic duty in trying to stop the health system from being overwhelmed, but partly also because they were personally fearful of what the virus might mean for them. And as time has gone on and we've begun to learn more about the virus and how it's possible to potentially be infected with COVID-19 and not have any knowledge of it at all, that I think people perhaps feel a little more battle-hardened by all of this, and they don't think of the virus as being as quite as potent an enemy as they did first time round.
Again, I'm going to say the evidence doesn't support that. So we have a consistent measure of people's anxiety about the virus. It's a simple score out of 10. It's been running since the very start, in fact, of the pandemic.
Are these the Amoric surveys this latest, that David's been commissioning?
Yeah, and in this latest surge that we've had in Christmas and January, that level of anxiety about the virus has got right back up to the levels that it was at during March and April of last year. And in a way, that's quite surprising because people knew less about it then. And you might expect people to be more frightened of something they know less about. And as you rightly say, as we've become used to the risk, you might think that would change people's perception of it. But the evidence suggests not, actually. And there may be some good reasons for that, of course. I mean, you know, we do probably have quite a lot of anxiety now about all the stories that surround the new variants, and we don't really know yet what the implications of those new variants mm-hmm. are going to be for the long term. So I think there still is a level of anxiety, and I think that's primarily what's driving people's behavior, and that's why the overwhelming majority are staying at home and doing the right thing. I think it is really important to be looking forward and giving people hope here. I mean, obviously, the vaccine gives us that, and that's important. But there's also positive feedback that we should give. I mean, we have started to get on top of this third curve. Case numbers are starting to come down again, and we've got to keep doing what we're doing. That is happening because of our behavior. That is happening precisely because of our response. And basic psychology will tell you that if you give people positive feedback, say, look, the behavior you are engaging in is working, that it, you know, that's good. It's going to help them to keep going and give them some motivation. And it really is working. I mean, what we are doing at the moment, the sacrifices that people are making, is flattening this third curve, and it is making a real difference.
Okay. By the way, we've had a tweet in from Camilla who says, why is it always a middle-class perspective on lockdown? The image created is of families in houses that are itching to get out, but there's zero focus on people in overcrowded housing, families in hotel rooms, students sharing bedrooms, and people living with violence, etc., which is a very fair point, and they are marginalised communities that sometimes get left out of these conversations, and we shouldn't forget about them. When we go back to the point about whether people are adhering or not, and again, I take your argument about the surveys that Nevitt has been commissioning, but before we came on air this morning, I just said that to try and find some sort of hard data to prove that maybe people are a bit more mobile now than they were last year, anyone who drives in and out of city centres will know that city centres themselves are still pretty abandoned, but that the suburban traffic on the way in and out is much heavier now than it was in the first lockdown. And a lot of people thought when it was heavier in October, November, it was because the schools were still back, and as we know, they mobilise a lot of people. But there's still been pretty heavy traffic this time around. And here's just an example, just for comparison. If you take the M7 at Newlands Cross, the Red Cow interchange, on the way into Dublin, probably the busiest road in Ireland because of how all the western and southern traffic comes in from that way. On April the 13th last year, that was the second Monday of full lockdown. At most, in any hour, there was never any more than 500 cars driving inwards towards Dublin city centre. This year, if you look at Monday just gone, it was the second working Monday of a full lockdown. At peak time, there was never any less than 3,200 cars on the same road going in the same direction. Traffic is six times higher now than it was last springtime. And it's individual instances like that, Pete, which make people wonder whether there is still the same adherence.
Okay, so 2 points in response to what you've said there. I mean, the first one, I just want to respond on the class issue. I'm not coming from any perspective. What I'm saying here is what the data tell us. And very interestingly, actually, the data tell us that adherence to the restrictions changes very, very little by socioeconomic status.
Yeah, to be fair, I think Camilla's point was about me and the media framing of this. It wasn't directed at you, but point taken anyway.
No, but I just want to make the point because it's really important, because people do make assumptions that there are large class differences in the way people are responding to the restrictions, and actually the data suggests that there aren't. So the second thing is, you are right. The traffic data suggests there's more traffic this time around than last time. It's really important to understand something here, though. This lockdown is not as severe as the lockdown that we had in March and April. I mean, the lockdown we had in March and April had more businesses closed, had stronger restrictions on people going to work, and had people only going 2 kilometers from their home. So we haven't actually gone back to the same level of lockdown. Now, do I think that in this case, it is probably the case that there are more people going particularly to office jobs who perhaps could be staying at home and maybe should be staying at home? Well, yes, I've seen some data that suggests that could be true. We need better data. We need to be monitoring that better because that's a really important issue. And workplaces are one of the places that community transmission is taking place. And therefore, this virus is getting from one household to the next. And with the volume of disease that is out there at the moment, that is an important issue. So I would accept, yeah, you're absolutely right. Traffic numbers do suggest there's more traffic. That's partly because the lockdown isn't as severe. And it may be partly because there's some working activity that's going on that really, in the spirit of the current restrictions, shouldn't be. And it would be better if we were monitoring that and trying to make sure that people were working from home wherever possible. Mm. And usually, particularly for office jobs, it really is possible.
On the topic of motivation, and you mentioned some of the concerns around the new variants, let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of people will have heard the news from Boris Johnson last Friday suggesting that the B117 variant, the one that originated in southeast England, potentially has a higher mortality rate. It turned out that when some of the scientists got to speak afterwards, that perhaps it had been presented a little bit sensationally. Let's have a listen to what Matt Hancock has had to say about that this morning.
Communicating risk is challenging, and it's challenging for media outlets as well. I understand that. But when we put the scientific evidence out there, there are uncertainties in that. That's the nature of science. And the thing I find heartening is the vast majority of the public understand that. And that can lead to stray headlines, you know, because the science is uncertain. But what really matters is what people need to do. And that, of course, is to stay at home. And I think it's very important that everybody listens to the scientists who, of course, explain the nuances in what we do know and what we don't know. And communicating risk and uncertainty is one of the hardest things to communicate. But I think it's incumbent on all of us to explain that there are uncertainties here, but there are some things that are clear.
So that's Matt Hancock, the UK Health Secretary, speaking to Sky News earlier on about the difficulties in communicating. This was followed on by Boris Johnson announcing that there was perhaps 30% higher mortality as a result of that new variant, but also not explaining that it might therefore result in 13 deaths out of 1,000 infections rather than 10. So the base number is still low. It does raise an interesting point, Pete. And again, I'll perfectly say hold my hands up here and say that, you know, people like myself and others in the media have a responsibility here, where sometimes we can rush to try and present things in a very binary, blunt way, talking about things like 30% higher mortality and not either allowing the good news to get through or not allowing more context to be communicated.
Yeah, I mean, that was a particularly bad example. So one of the classic things that happens when science makes it into politics is that people confuse percentages and percentage points. So there are bound to be some people who, listening to what Boris Johnson had said and the headlines that followed from it, you know, immediately had a panic that what was being said was that, you know, the death rate from this virus was jumping from just, you know, 1 or 2 percentages percent to somewhere up in the 30s or something, because people confuse the difference between percentages and percentage points. It's a classic problem. It happens in all walks of life where statistics and politics interact, in my experience working for the SRI, and it's very unfortunate. And I think that was a bad error, actually, because I think that's one that is known really well amongst the science and policy community. And, you know, whoever is writing those speaking points needs to be really, really aware of it. So, yeah, I mean, Matt Hancock is right that it's difficult to communicate risk and uncertainty to the public. It is. And we also know that people's reasoning with risk and uncertainty, including the reasoning of scientists, incidentally, tends to show quite strong biases. We're not intuitively very good at it. But there are some clear mistakes that you can make. And what came out of Boris's announcement was a clear mistake that should have been avoided.
One question just before I let you go, one that's come in from Twitter. Ask Pete about how the sense of potential loss outweighs the sense of potential gain with regards to the vaccine rollout, and how, you know, sometimes people might be inclined to feel very optimistic that vaccines are beginning to roll out, but then when they hear that deliveries of Oxford AstraZeneca are going to be delayed, or that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine gets delayed for a week, that suddenly they begin to get much more fatalistic than they should.
So somebody there has read a bit of behavioral science. So there is a thing called loss aversion, which says that we tend to weight in our decision making and judgments losses more strongly than gains. And this is true. In general, we respond more to losses than we do to equivalent gains. So it may well be that where there are negative headlines about the virus, they're getting a little bit, sorry, about the vaccine, they're getting a little more weight than maybe they should, where, you know, it might be a hiccup of a week or so in the context of a pandemic that's lasting more than a year and may last as much as two and so on. And, you know, in the great scheme of things, when we look back on it, a lot of stories that seem big at the time will in fact appear to be small. But it's partly because people want that sense of hope, and if they've really got that sense of hope that we might have an end in sight here, then headlines that dent that really do feel like losses at the moment. So we do need to be super careful about that. We do need to be really careful in communicating what the level of doubt and uncertainty is that surrounds some of these stories. I mean, one of the things I really hope that the public has learned a lot during this pandemic is that actually, you know, knowledge and science and the way it's communicated and the way it gets across to the public, it changes. It's very uncertain. And it develops all the time, and it can go both positively and negatively. But across a long period of time, those swings are going to go in both directions. I mean, the overall picture is if you'd taken where we were at 3 or 4 months ago, you know, we now have what appear to be and still appear to be very effective vaccines compared to what we could have expected. And they are now rolling out. And that is the hope that we need to cling on to here and that needs to motivate us to get on top of this disease and suppress it.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, Pete. Thanks so much for your insight this morning. That's Professor Pete Lunn, who's a professor in behavioural economics, and he's involved with the ESRI as well.